It is again a gift to be here with you. Please turn to 1 Corinthians 7. Just want to give a special thanks to those of you who've been praying, and also to those of you who've taken time to dig into this passage this week. We are heading into some challenging material here. Some passages that are highly controversial, and some that most of us would say have been misconstrued and misused. Up until this week, actually, I was eager to dig into this. I'd been working on it some, and was excited about it. But as I started realizing more about the complexity of this chapter and the issues involved, I admit that my enthusiasm all but evaporated. Even figuring out how much to try to cover in this sermon was harder than usual. And as I told Brother Paul, I think it was yesterday, I've not managed to stay in the quiet confidence posture very consistently this week. So we'll wade in. But I have to remind myself, and I remind you as well, that although it is right that I feel keenly the responsibility to handle the word carefully, I share with all of you the responsibility to discern what God is trying to tell us through this study. Remember that the buck doesn't stop with me. That brings me relief, and I think it probably should you as well. Now, you won't be shocked when I say that understanding the historical context of this passage is going to be critical to understanding the text correctly. So we'll dive in and look at that some more. Just to let you know, I'm trying hard not to clear my throat too much this morning. Let me remind you of a quote. from Demosthenes, it's not on the screen, sorry, a Greek orator from several centuries before Paul's time. I used this last time. He said, "Mistresses we keep for the sake of pleasure, concubines for the daily care of our persons, but wives to bear us legitimate children and to be faithful guardians of our households." And that was a while before Paul. I'm hopeful that you'll remember some of the background I've given in other messages that depict the lamentable moral state of the empire. Again, it is not so much different from the culture we are surrounded by. I'm hard-pressed to say which I think is further down the slope to complete moral collapse. Ben Witherington III cites a number of sources from his assessment of Roman marriages. He says that in the empire, marriage had very little to do with love or affection. In fact, the partners often had little personal choice in the matter, but it had everything to do with bettering your material or social position. This is a strange connection to make, but I had to think of the short story, "Love is a Fallacy." How many of you read that? Okay, a good handful of you. Here are the opening sentences. I think it was written maybe in the 1940s. "Cool was I and logical, keen, calculating, perspicacious," I don't even know what that means, "acute and astute. I was all of these. My brain was as powerful as a dynamo, as precise as a chemist's scales, as penetrating as a scalpel. And, think of it, I was only 18. He then launches into an exchange with his dorm mate and comes back to talk about Polly, whom they both had an interest in. "I had long coveted Polly Espy. Let me emphasize that my desire for this young woman was not emotional in nature. She was, to be sure, a girl who excited the emotions, but I was not one to let my heart rule my head. I wanted Polly for a shrewdly calculating, calculated, entirely cerebral reason. I was a freshman in law school. In a few years, I would be out in practice. I was well aware of the importance of the right kind of wife in furthering a lawyer's career. The successful lawyers I had observed were, almost without exception, married to beautiful, gracious, intelligent women. With one omission, Polly fitted these specifications perfectly. Well, if you appreciate gagging and need a good laugh, you'll want to read the rest of that story yourself. We see this as far-fetched and a laughable way of thinking. But my point is that this is not completely different from the Roman way of thinking about marriage. A few decades after Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, Tacitus, a writer and politician, wrote that his father-in-law, Agricola, quote, derived credit and support in his pursuit of greater things, end quote, from his marriage. Marriage was a means to what he needed. In another work, Tacitus wrote about the German people, implying the stark contrast to his own Roman world. I quote, "Their marriage code, however, is strict, and indeed no part of their manners is more praiseworthy. They are content with one wife. Still better is the condition of those states in which only maidens," meaning virgins, "are given in marriage, and where the hopes and expectations of a bride are then finally terminated or fulfilled. They receive one husband as having one body and one life, that they may have no thoughts beyond, no further reaching desires, that they may love not so much the husband as the married estate." Remember, the reason this was worth writing about was because of how different it was from his Roman readers' experience. Marriage was about enhancing your and your family's social standing or making it more secure. It was about manipulating anything within your control to acquire or secure your or your family's wealth. It was about pursuing honor and avoiding shame. That was marriage in the Roman world. I was unprepared for this next part. Witherington says further that in Roman culture, a husband was typically much older than his wife, such that their relationship would have been more like an uncle or a niece, an uncle and a niece, or even a father and a daughter. In fact, Alain Rousseau says that women in the empire, including Jews, were often given in marriage by the age of 12. And they were often bearing children within several years. Tacitus's commentary on the Germans again implicitly provides a contrast. "The youths partake late of the pleasures of love and hence pass the age of puberty unexhausted. Nor are the virgins hurried into marriage. The same maturity, the same full growth is required. The sexes unite equally matched and robust." Roman marriage was not necessarily formalized with a ceremony. Although legal documents were preferable, both marriage and divorce could simply happen by verbal agreement. And a husband could dismiss his wife with a simple, "Take your things and go." I hope you're getting the picture of what the situation was like for women. This was in the seemingly advanced civilization of the Roman Empire. And yet women, even women of the upper classes, were scarcely more than property. If they wanted to be held in honor, they were expected to be modest, restrained, and chaste. By contrast, their husbands were expected to be sexually promiscuous, and it was assumed that their primary interest in their wives was for the children they had together. In contrast to wives, the women who were available to these men for sexual pleasure were not generally expected to be virtuous. Many were slaves, but even the free women were little more than property. In fact, some of the same laws of commerce applied to both female slaves and female livestock. particularly in regards to their reproductive capacity. Now, there is an added complexity here that is pivotal for understanding our text today. It is that, in addition to the more conventional pressures that the Corinthian believers faced, the stuff I've just been talking about, there was also the pressure from a dissenting voice of asceticism, most notably from the Stoics. Asceticism is the belief that we can become spiritually better by renouncing worldly or bodily pleasures. This is a really important concept in this chapter. To give just a few examples, Musonius Rufus, a Stoic philosopher who was roughly Paul's contemporary, said that sexual intercourse is legitimate only if it is within marriage and only if it is for the purpose of begetting children. It is, quote, unjust and unlawful when it is mere pleasure-seeking, even in marriage, end quote. Seneca the Younger, also contemporary to Paul, wrote this: if you consider sexual passion to have been bestowed on mankind not for the sake of pleasure but for the continuance of the race, all other desires will pass harmlessly by one who is safe even from this secret plague. How the licentious view of sex and marriage had an impact on the Corinthian church is easy enough to understand. This was what many of them knew in their unconverted life. But it's also not hard to see how asceticism made its mark on the Corinthian church, as some people began to be repulsed by the wrongness of a wanton lifestyle. They were attracted to what amounted to an overcorrection. So, in summary, a woman's value was primarily determined by her usefulness to someone else, either her family, her husband, or her master. Sexual promiscuity was very common, and the pressure to attain social status was intense. Mixed into this volatile cocktail was the reactionary ascetic idealism of the Stoic philosophy. Frankly, it's no wonder that the Corinthian church was having major struggles. And it is in this context that Paul makes some astounding claims about the marriage relationship. Now, let me just insert here, I won't be surprised if some of what I see this morning clashes with the way that you have read this chapter in the past. I will say that my understanding has shifted significantly since I dug into this more, and I want to be clear that I have not arrived. My understanding continues to be shaped by my studying and by your responses to my messages. So, as always, please listen carefully, even critically, and don't accept my perspective as the final word. I'll be very interested in hearing what you have discovered in your own study. Before we read this text, let me mention that Witherington helped me to see a number of clear motifs in this chapter. You see the verse numbers there where they're shown. Don't try to change your marital or ethnic or social status unless it conflicts with a life of peace and obedience. And then there are several references there that give Paul's reason for stressing this, don't try to change. And then there are Paul's underlying motivations. I want you to be free to please the Lord. Look how often that shows up here. And finally, I wish that you were all like I am. That also shows up a number of times. I've limited my text to the first five verses, but this chapter does really stand as one unit. So I'd like to read at least through verse 16. Often I'd feel self-conscious about taking such a short section, just five verses, but this time I don't. First of all, the extended cultural background that I just gave is going to be needed for the rest of this chapter as well. And secondly, many of these topics are current and relevant enough, in my estimation, that I don't mind plowing a little deeper. Would you please stand for the reading of the word? 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1 in the ESV. Now, concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now, as a concession, not a command, I say this. I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single, as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married I give this charge, not I, but the Lord, the wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. To the rest I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? You may be seated. One thing that we can't fail to notice is the change in tone between the previous sections and this one. Ever since chapter 3, but especially in chapters 5 and 6, Paul is raising his voice, getting in their face, as it were. He is exercising his authority, even though he is not present with them. His repeated use of rhetorical questions makes his confrontations even sharper. Here is just a quick sampling. Some are arrogant, as though I were not coming to you, but I will come to you soon, if the Lord wills, and I will find out, not the talk of these arrogant people, but their power. For the kingdom of God does not consist in talk, but in power. What do you wish? Shall I come to you with a rod or with love in a spirit of gentleness? It is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you and of a kind that is not tolerated even among pagans. For a man has his father's wife, and you are arrogant. Ought you not rather to mourn? Let him who has done this be removed from among you. For though absent in body, I am present in spirit, and as if present, I have already pronounced judgment on the one who did such a thing. When one of you has a grievance against another, does he dare go to law before the unrighteous instead of the saints? And finally, do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Contrast that tone with chapter 7 and beyond. Here he seems to be acknowledging that there are gray areas that may need nuance. It's important to have sexual relations with your spouse, but there may be exceptions. It's better to remain unmarried, but it's not a sin to marry. I'm saying this for your good, not to restrict you. That's the tone that we get in chapter 7. David Garland makes this observation about chapter 7. Remember that in the previous passages, in previous verse chapters, Paul was drawing a hard, straight line. Garland says, Paul does not offer a one-size-fits-all guideline. He treats each person as a responsible moral agent who must learn how to please God in his or her circumstances. The obligation to avoid fornication and to be obedient to the word of the Lord is the only absolute. Notice that the opening line in verse 1, it is good, is repeated twice later in the chapter. I think Paul is acknowledging that at least on the matters he addresses here, the Corinthians are truly wanting the good. And so he doesn't want to come across too strongly, it seems. But as Garland points out, Paul tweaks the meaning of good. The proponents of asceticism were saying that celibacy is a morally or spiritually superior good. Paul subtly but unmistakably changes this to say that celibacy can be beneficial or honorable or a better good, but it's not more spiritual. I found it challenging to understand the structure of this chapter. Gordon Fee insists that the core message of this chapter is remain as you are. Everything else pivots on this point, he says. Garland cites him and affirms his perspective. But Anthony Thistleton disagrees. He says, Paul's injunctions are to be content with one's I didn't read that right. Paul's injunctions to be content with one's situation are not his central point, but offer an antidote to a Corinthian desire to change everything with their newfound status. I think I lean toward the latter approach, but I can see why Fee comes to his conclusion, and you can decide for yourself. I predict that our first reaction to Paul's emphasis here is going to be discomfort. Why doesn't he talk about the other important aspects of marriage? Well, David Garland's concise answer helps ease my discomfort a bit. He says, in the opening paragraphs of this chapter, Paul is preoccupied with the sexual part of marriage because that is the problem in Corinth. End quote. With that, let's now step our way through this. Verse 1, now concerning in a lot of translations, actually. When Paul starts with that, there is a fairly general agreement that this is a signal that he is responding to something that he has heard from the Corinthians. It shows up again in verse 25 and four other times in this letter. Some of your translations have the next statement in quotes. This is, of course, a translator's decision, since the earliest manuscripts had no punctuation. But there is convincing evidence in the following verses that Paul is indeed quoting something that the Corinthians wrote in their letter. I'll get to that in a bit, but let's examine the statement first. Some translations say it is good for a man not to touch a woman. What does that mean? Well, I'll quote the NET Bible note on this, translation note on this, but I've read the same thing from multiple other sources. This idiom occurs 10 times in Greek literature, and all of the references except one appear to refer to sexual relations. So, why do I say that Paul is quoting someone else? And if he is quoting someone else, does he agree with the statement? Well, let's start with what we know for sure. Paul's teachings, in general, affirm the rest of Paul's teachings affirm that God's design for marriage is one man and one woman for life. Every other sexual relation is sin. D.F. Wright says this with simple clarity. By divine appointment, marriage and sexuality go together, as do singleness and abstinence from sex. What God has joined together, humans should not separate. So, without question, Paul would affirm that an unmarried man should not touch or have sexual relations with a woman. But this statement is broader than that. It is making the point that it is good for a married man not to have sexual relations with his wife. Does Paul support that view? Well, if we had time, we could compare this statement with a pile from other places in Scripture. But let's simply look at one in Paul's first letter to Timothy. This is chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. Now, the Spirit expressly says that in later times, some will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and teachings of demons through the insincerity of liars whose consciences are seared, who forbid marriage and require abstinence from food that God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. Sharp words. I don't know about you, but I think we're seeing the emphatic side of Paul again here. Are you connecting this with anything? To me, it's clear that Paul is referring to the ascetic influence that I was describing earlier. And I concur with many commentators who see this as a position that some in the Corinthian church were promoting. If you want to see some reasons for why I say that, ask for my footnotes. Now, Paul is left with the delicate task of correcting this misguided zeal, and he wades in cautiously. Let's examine his response. What does having his own wife and have her own husband, I didn't quite read that right, have his own wife and have her own husband mean? At first glance, it looks like it means that everybody should get married, right? And to make you squirm a little more, the reason for this is because people can't resist temptation to sexual immorality. In the words of a generation younger than mine, that's a wild thing to say. But I think we can do better. The literal translation of this phrase is, let each man be having his own wife and each woman be having her own husband. In biblical Greek, it means either to be married or to have continuing sexual relations, not to get married. In total, Phi cites 8 uses of this phrase in the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint, and 9 in the New Testament. Here are 2 examples. Notice how substituting marry a wife doesn't make sense in either of these cases, if you would adjust the tense, because the marriage, if there was an official marriage, has already happened. From just 2 chapters before in Corinthians here, it is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you and of a kind that is not tolerated even among pagans, for a man has his father's wife. And from Luke, and they asked him a question saying, teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies having a wife, there it is, but no children, the man must take the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. Now, this one in particular makes the point well. Having a wife, the first one there, uses the same Greek phrase as verse 2 in our text, but must take the widow, meaning must marry the widow, is a different phrase in the Greek. Does that make sense? So, no, Paul can't mean that everybody should get married. We're back then to the 2 other options. Could it mean be married to? Let's try that. But because of sexual immoralities, each man should be married to his own wife, and each woman should be married to her own husband. That seems just a little awkward and unhelpful to me. So I concur with many scholars that Paul is referring to every husband having sexual relations with his wife in an ongoing way, and every wife having sexual relations with her husband. Well, I think that helps my discomfort a bit. But is the main reason for sexual relations within marriage really because married people are just too likely to slip into sexual immorality? Phi emphatically rejects the temptation insertion by the ESV, the one I read, and others. He sees this talking about the phrase because of sexual immoralities. He sees this talking about something that is already happening and proposes that Paul is referring to the previous chapter, chapter 6, where some were going to prostitutes. So, a paraphrase of verses 1 and 2 might be this. Now, you said in your letter that some people are saying it is good for a man to avoid having sexual relations with a woman. But in light of the cases of sexual immoralities with prostitutes, right among your own people, each married man should be participating in sexual relations with his own wife, and each married woman should be participating in sexual relations with her own husband. Further, as each of the writers I encountered said firmly, Paul is not writing a systematic theology of marriage here. He is addressing a specific question or concern raised by these ascetic-leaning Corinthians, or the contingent of those people. And he is giving just one relevant reason why abstaining from sexual relations in a marriage is a bad idea. So no, contrary to how I think many have understood this, Paul is not saying that everybody should get married because of the risk of falling into sin if they don't. I'll address this more later on, but for now, let me just quote Garland. His intention is not to argue that marriage is necessary to avoid fornication, but to argue that sexual asceticism has only a limited, if any, place in the marriage relationship. In verses 3 and 4, Paul proceeds to expound on his instruction here. Note first that Paul consistently refers to a marriage partner's responsibility. This exposes a glaring flaw in the Western worldview that has evolved into a fixation on one's rights. Has anybody not noticed that? With very little attention given to one's responsibilities. We've come a long way in 60 years when President Kennedy offered this memorable challenge: ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. How much more should spouses be applying this to their marriage? Notice how also in this first section, Paul is very careful to address both the husband and the wife on every point. Think back to the Greco-Roman view of women in general and wives in particular. With this kind of teaching, he was truly calling the Corinthians to swim upstream. But consider what a life-giving change this would have meant for the female believers. As Fee puts it, it is not the privilege of the husband and the duty of the wife. It is the duty of both and the privilege of both. Fee also notes the emphasis on mutuality, the perfect symmetry of these instructions. Then he makes a statement that is probably not very popular, but I offer it for your consideration. The way to correct an abuse of mutual relations is not to make demands on the offending party only, but to emphasize the mutual responsibility of each. Consider that. Now, for a bit of application here. This is simply a reminder, but it bears repeating in this context. Mutuality doesn't start or end in the bedroom. Mutuality is not keeping score. I'll give you a 10-minute massage if you give me a 10-minute massage. The tone here, and in Ephesians 5, is a focus on serving. And in this congregation, we have had a rich heritage of exemplary serving. Think of Fred taking care of Mary, of my Aunt Fanny caring for Eli for the majority of their married life, of my father caring for Mom with the challenges of dementia. Think of Melvin and Fanny's sweet and funny relationship. Too nearly half of you probably weren't around or old enough to appreciate some of these. But more recently, think of Susanna tirelessly nursing David back to health, or Arthur caring for Lil after her surgeries. Obviously, the focus here is on married couples, There is a lot more to be said about the unmarried, but that's coming later. For now, I repeat, wholeness and fulfillment and true mutuality in marriage comes from focusing on our responsibilities, not our rights. It comes when we focus on serving, not on being served. And lest we miss Paul's primary point in this paragraph, while it doesn't start or end in the bedroom, it does include the bedroom. Verse 5, just to make sure now that he has made his point abundantly clear, Paul says it one more way. Do not deprive one another. There has been a lot of discussion about the tense of this verb and how to translate it. The New American translates this, stop depriving one another. It's a judgment call, but as I understand it, I do believe that this is a legitimate and perhaps the most natural way to translate it. Many have noted that each of the sections in this paragraph have some form of an exception clause, and that is what we have here in verse 5. It is indeed an exception clause, but it is loaded with restrictions on the exception. If you are going to deprive each other, and that word can actually mean defraud, it's translated defraud elsewhere in the New Testament. If you are going to deprive each other, it must be by mutual agreement, it must be only for a limited time, and for the purpose of devoting yourself to prayer, it must be terminated by coming together again. You may have caught this phrase from the Stoic philosopher I quoted at the beginning. Sexual intercourse is unjust and unlawful when it is mere pleasure-seeking, even in marriage. This seems clearly to have been the view of the Corinthian ascetics. And actually, the broader Roman culture, according to Witherington, viewed sex within marriage the same way. So Paul here presents another really radical, countercultural proposition. This is new and different. He never even mentions procreation, and it's really hard to argue that he isn't advocating sex within marriage for the simple purpose of mutual pleasure. This aligns with what he said in Ephesians 5, especially verse 25. Husbands are to love like Jesus, who gave himself up for his bride. And verses 28 and 29 say, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. For every man feeds and cares for his own body. My paraphrase. Paul isn't going out on a limb with what he's saying here. He is simply building on the foundation of the Jewish scriptures. This mutual love is exactly what the Song of Songs sings about. Sex is not only, and arguably not primarily, about procreation. This section is a solid reminder that marriage is a sacrament, a bringing together of the physical and the spiritual, a physical experience that makes the spiritual reality it represents more real. Now, for a few more personal or practical notes. Notice in that exception clause in verse 5, by mutual agreement. When Paul says in verse 4 that a spouse doesn't have authority over his or her own body, I don't think he means that either partner loses their voice or agency or the freedom to express desires. I think it is a particularly this whole thing is a particularly interesting dance for newlyweds. They want to please each other. They don't want to impose their own preferences too strongly, etc. I think I've watched that a little bit with a newlywed close to me. You've probably heard about the couple who tried hard to please each other. For years, the wife ate the brown pieces of chicken and the husband the white pieces because she thought he liked the white, and he thought she liked the brown. Finally, they stumbled onto the truth that each preferred the meat they were not eating. So, we do each other a favor when we are honest about our preferences. we do not lose our voice when we say our spouse has authority over our body. The other phrase here that we've already encountered and maybe is just one of those that's uncomfortable. So Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. This self-control term is a puzzling one in this passage. I've already talked about the first occurrence. There are four others, two in verse 9, and then two in verses 36 and 37. Commentators have talked about the inadequacy. Some of them have ranted about the inadequacy of most translations to capture the sense of this verse in the original. Thistleton uses more words to give the nuance here, and I've found it helpful. I'll just read the whole verse there. Stop depriving one another of what is due in marriage, except perhaps by mutual agreement for a specific span of time that you may find unhurried time for prayer and then come together again. The goal would be nullified if Satan went on putting you through trials beyond your self-control. The sense that I started to get as I studied this is similar to how I might advise someone who is new to the spiritual discipline of solitude. I might say to them, the goal of your time is to draw near to God and to hear from him. So the more time you can give this, the better. But if you find yourself getting distracted and frustrated, you won't be getting much out of your time alone, so it's fine to quit. Give yourself a few times to get used to it, and it will probably go better. If you were new to solitude, would you agree that that would probably kind of ease the tension for you a bit? It certainly did for me when I started with that practice. Leaning heavily on Thistleton's writing, I'm pretty sure that this tone, the way I just talked, is the intent of each of the references to self-control in this chapter, except for verse 2, as I mentioned earlier. My goal is not to water down Scripture, rather it is to attempt to represent the meaning here as faithfully as I can. Again, just because Paul's approach is gentler in this section doesn't mean that he is fudging in any way on sexual immorality. Nowhere does he hint that if outside of marriage you struggle with self-control, it's okay to get sexually involved. Nothing of the sort. What he is offering here is a way forward for those who are married or could get married and are struggling with self-control. Mutuality in marriage. As he was offering hope for the gut-wrenching societal brokenness of the Roman Empire, so he is offering us hope for the gut-wrenching brokenness of the Western society. Now, kind of an aside here, I want to thank those of you who aren't married for your patience in listening to yet another sermon on marriage. You can tell, I trust, that I didn't go looking for this. It was just here. But as I hinted at, this chapter is going to give us a good opportunity to look at the bigger picture also. For all of you, I encourage you to dig into the rest of this chapter to see what you can learn. Let's kneel for prayer. I just thank you again, Lord, that your desire, your heart, your passion is to reveal yourself to us. We acknowledge that we limit that process by our own carnality, our own short-sightedness, our own limitations with our confusion and impatience. But God, we accept what you've given us in this chapter as your word for us, and we want to learn from it and grow from it, to be shaped by it. Obviously, Lord, this was for a part of this audience today. I ask that we who are married will think carefully about what Paul was saying here. In Jesus' name, amen.